My advice to you, start drinking heavily.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Hello and welcome to Action Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pappas in studio. Matt Byrne on the board. We're loaded up here this morning. We should have Mr. Flanagan. We should have Mr. O'Neill. And we should have Ms. Audrey Johnson. A lot of stuff to talk about today. We got, guys, is this like Obituary Monday, Greg? For God's sake, we got like four people to talk about today. All of them interesting in their own way, and sorry to see them all go. SP Futures down 17, NASDAQ Futures down 62. This is after a down day on Friday that saw the... actually, the market came back quite a bit on the close, but even with that, we were still down, just as a way of review. It looked like we were going to pull a rug on everything, but we weren't. Dow was down 333, S&P down 66, NASDAQ down 298. It doesn't really look like it came back much, does it, Greg? But it really did, didn't it?
Yeah, but don't worry. Bitcoin coming back.
Bitcoin coming back? Coming back from where?
Well, it's up $140.
$93,790. What are we going to do if that thing totally collapses? Are they going to take the market with it?
You would imagine. I mean, it's kind of a leading indicator.
Yeah, it's... it's
some people say as long as Bitcoin's going up, we need to raise rates.
Oh, God. Well, you know, there's a spot to be said for that. The money supply came out, I believe, on Friday, and if you take the month, it would be the November month.
But we don't believe these numbers, so...
I think you believe the money supply numbers. Well, more than you do the other ones, anyway. It shows a 6.8% or 6.9% annual gain. Explain to me, Lucy, how is that fighting inflation?
Because if we didn't fight inflation, it would be 10 and 11%.
God, you are this new generation. I love it. I love it. It's not 40. What are you talking about? It's going. We want Kevin and Jen. We had a. Hey guys, we were going to talk. First of all, good morning. An early Happy New Year. We were going to talk about Jimmy Carter. We're going to in the economic policy. We're going to talk about Greg Gumbel. Serious loss. I always liked that guy. Plus, he's a Southsider, De La Salle. We were going to talk a little bit about Ricky Henderson, but maybe we can put him off. And now we have Warren. What the hell's the guy's last name? We have Warren. Warren Red Upton, 105-year-old last survivor of Pearl Harbor, died on Christmas Day.
I'll be damned.
So we got guys. He was on the USS Utah. Which is still a memorial.
Well, I suppose we're not going to get to Linda Lavin, huh?
I know. Well, maybe. Okay. You never know. But the USS Utah, for those that don't know, is one of the two ships that's still there, the Arizona obviously being the other one, that if he wanted to, he could have his ashes put on the Utah. I don't think that's what he wants to do, but anyway, he could have. He could have been the last person.
He's not talking now, so.
Well, it would have been, hopefully, in his will or something. If
maybe,
he wanted that.
Yep.
But the Utah just rolled over, and they never made any attempt to salvage it or get it the hell out of there because it would have cost too much money. There's still 56 or something bodies on the thing. And I think they found out later that weren't there people still pounding away? People lived in there a lot longer than people thought they did. They essentially gave up on people. They were trying to cut through the hull to try and let people out if they had made it to the top and were in air bubbles. And I think the word is they gave up before the people died. Yet another horrible story about war. But so what do you want to do first, Jimmy Carter or Greg Gumbel?
Let's hit up Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested in John's perspective on him.
Yeah, well, you know, he was probably the biggest outlier in the presidential selection or election history that I can think of. Somebody who really could only have been elected, I think, at that time in history, coming as it did after the Nixon and Ford administrations, and the country had be soured on politics. That was a great opportunity for somebody like Carter, who always wore the, you know, robes of power very lightly. That's one of his most appealing things, is that he was kind of an aw shucks guy, not, you know, smart as a whip, but, you know, very non, you know, assertive in many ways. And his public persona probably, you know, got him his one term and no more in retrospect, because he was perhaps too nice a guy for the presidency. But he really gave an example of what, you know, presidents in tough times need to do. And, you know, his political future be damned, pretty much. I can't think of anybody after that who isn't much more crass and self-serving in their objectives coming into the White House, let alone when they leave it. And Carter is an example of somebody who, you know, say what you will about his policies, and, you know, I disagree with his approach to nuclear energy and, you know, Panama Canal and some other things, but overall, you know, I give him pretty high marks as somebody who did the tough stuff and took the hit for it and never really looked back, kind of like Truman in many ways too. But Carter had a smaller stage to play it on. We need some example like that now with the inflation we're facing, and I don't think we have it. So it behooves us to kind of, you know, recollect what Carter did and the hit he took for it, and, you know, helped us dodge a bullet. I don't see that kind of leadership now.
So. John, do you, as scary as it may seem, there's, in my, well, as I'm going to ask, in my opinion, there's very similarities between him and Trump. Because after Spiro Agnew got tossed out unceremoniously, like right away, right? And then Nixon was in there, and we had all kinds of inflation. We had wage price controls. Then he was out. And
as somebody who didn't live through that time, here's a question to you guys. Was the main reason he was elected, was Ford? People didn't like that Ford gave the pardon to Nixon, or what?
That was a big part of
that
it.
That was a big part?
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it, and it was just the whole taint of Nixon and all the scandals to the entire Republican Party. So it was really, you know, what is it? I think it's six words that were a theme for Carter through his campaign, and that's, I will never lie to you. And that resonated, and he, you know, he could back that up. There, you know, he didn't have that smarmy politician way about him, so that was it. I think what undermined him the most was he never was able to convert that into an optimistic vision for America that people could latch on to. You know, he could talk about the great national malaise, but he never was able to convert that into, okay, so where are we going from here? And I think that, you know, that made it pretty easy for Reagan to come in afterwards, because he did have, you know, I know Tom likes to use the quote, was it a Royko quote? You know,
amazingly, what is myopic vision of an America that never existed, or something like that.
Yeah, but what he did have was a vision that he could describe to people, that and everybody could say, yes, I want to march in that direction. And Carter never got to that. And all great leaders, you know, if you're really going to be a great leader, you have to be able to do that. Everybody's got to have some rallying point. I've heard it expressed as a not even a mission. I'm trying to think of the words that Simon Sinek uses. A just cause, almost. You know, what's your cause? And so
that became clearer after Office, right? With all the humanitarian.
Well, no, he was in a bad spot.
I think that
spot.
Was just who he was. I think his humanitarian efforts are who he was. He was a genuinely, he was a genuine man, and there weren't a lot of errors to him. So I think that part he was really good. But by then it was too late. Reagan was good at that. Even Trump has aspect of that. You know, when he's talking about making America great again and what that's going to mean, it is something where people can look and say, at least enough people who can set aside the flaws of Donald Trump and just listen to that and say, yeah, I want to go in that direction. And Biden never was able to do it because Biden wasn't able to articulate anything.
Well, it was a discussed over Washington too. And Jimmy Carter, he came from Georgia. Bill Clinton was somewhat the same way. The idea that if we get a governor in there, he won't be tainted by people. But his mistake was he brought some people with him from Georgia. Never really, what would the term be, Jan? Not really, you don't embrace the Washington thing once you get there, but you also have to deal with it as well. He was never as good at that. Inherited this inflation thing, which is pretty awful. He actually is the one who turned it around under Volcker, which, I'll tell that story in a bit. But also this thing with Iran, what was the final story? I know you guys are more Reagan fans than me. What was the dirty story behind they wouldn't let any of those hostages go till Reagan get in? What did Reagan promise those people?
Barbara Honecker has written about this in her book, October Surprise, and other people have kind of glanced at it. But it was a deal with William Casey and George H.W. Bush, who was, Reagan's running mate at the time, to bribe the Iranians not to release the hostages until after the election. And, of course, the Iranians did one better and didn't release the hostages to the minute that Reagan was inaugurated in January of 1981. One of the most disgusting, treasonous actions, I think, by anybody who eventually occupied the White House that I can think of.
Didn't Dan Inouye say it was the most disgusting thing that ever happened in America?
Oh, now, I mean, we've had a lot since then, so I have to, recalibrate my morals here. But at the time, and the way Carter responded to it, which was pretty much the same way that Humphrey responded to Nixon's machinations in 1968, when Nixon was trying to do the same thing with the North Vietnamese, conspiring behind everybody's back to twist public opinion in his favor in the election, and Humphrey knew about it and didn't go public about it. But it was equally repulsive, and Carter didn't make an issue of it that I recall, and he had good reason to. It's only been in hindsight you kind of put everything together. The thing that I remember in 1976, I had a pass on Amtrak for 3 weeks and took a vacation from work and took an extra week without pay. I just did the whole circuit, from East Coast to West Coast down to southern border, up the coast. I was watching the campaign during that whole trip because it was in October of 76, and the mood of the country was just awful.
Oh, it's terrible.
I mean, the cities were just, cities I didn't know very well that I kind of, stopped and spent some time in and was just kind of like depressed as all get out by what they looked like. I mean, New York, even Washington. Washington was pretty much, a depressed. Everything about it felt like it's just there's something hanging over everybody's mood. But I watched the debate, between Carter and Ford. And I was happy to be in St. Louis the night of that debate. I was watching it on TV. And that's the night that Ford sealed his fate, and I think got Carter elected. When they were asking in the debate about the Soviets' influence over the Eastern Bloc nations, and particularly Poland, and Ford denied that Russia had any, the Soviet Union had any influence over Poland, and the people on the questioning panel during the debate were aghast. That,
Ford give him a chance to correct it, but he didn't.
No, they gave him every opportunity to backtrack it. What you really, do you mean, you don't mean, and of course, Ford just blundered ahead. I thought, well, he lost the election.
I actually like Jerry Ford.
In retrospect, he wasn't, but he had the whole thing of coming after Nixon and what the mood of the country in 1974 was, when inflation had really started to take a toll, and recession of 73, 74, the oil embargo and gas prices and lines. 73, 74 was a bad year. That's when we came out of college.
I don't know a soul, except maybe Bob, who was in accounting. I don't know a soul who had a interview with anybody our senior year. All of us fled to grad school, right?
Right, because of the jobs, and
there was none. I don't know if anybody had any. Right. I mean,
And the ones that you got, were pretty much evaporated pretty quickly because everything was contracting much more visibly in my memory than it is now.
John, you mentioned the episode with the Iranians and George. I tell you what, I wonder at the end of the day in our lifetime, I hope somebody opens up these Kennedy things. I have a feeling that George H. One Bush was involved in every crappy thing the government did for about 15 years, including Kennedy's assassination. I honestly don't. He was a big agree. Time behind the Bag of Pigs. Wasn't he one of the architects of that? I mean, it fell apart. He was about, I think history might reflect, if somebody actually wrote about it, he could have been one of the worst people we've ever seen here.
And the fact that he had the CIA background before he was president, that's, I think, unprecedented in U.S. history, where we have a CIA director who became president. And with the stuff that he knew as CIA director during that time period, it makes me tremble when I think...
J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah. Well, you talked about the inflation piece, and I'll just tell the story very briefly. I think I've told it a couple of times, but actually, Carter... I have some numbers here. Now I'm looking at money supply numbers, which pretty much translates into inflation. But from 69 to 73, this is after what was the what's the name of the agreement in 68? And it was the I'll think of it. It was an economic agreement. We went off the gold standard, right? But to essentially pay for the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Because we were going to push money into the system, and we didn't want De Gaulle showing up with, essentially. Big bales of dollars saying, give me gold, because the gold was, the official price was what? It was $35 an ounce. Can you imagine that? But it was obviously, we didn't have enough gold for that. And De Gaulle was pissing everybody off by saying, I want my gold. Here's your dollars, type of thing. So went off the gold. Bretton Woods. Was it Bretton Woods?
Bretton Woods, yeah.
From 69 to 73, all Nixon, 42% increase in the money supply. It's 10 plus per year. 73 to 77, Nixon / Ford, 44% increase or 11% a year. Carter, he was 81 to 85, right? Or I mean, I'm sorry, he was 81 to 85. And, no, no, wait, whoa. He was
77 to 81.
77 to 81. 38% increase, slightly less. But the interesting part was on August 6, 1979, and, of course, if you ask anybody who appointed Volcker, they're going to tell you Reagan, which is BS. It was Carter. So, essentially, a year and a half before he went out of office, he appointed Volcker. But any of the history of the Federal Reserve, they went to Carter and they said, look, we've got to pull back this money supply if we're going to gotta get a different guy in the Fed. We've got to pull this back because this is what's caused the inflation. Finally, people listened to Milton Friedman. They said, but it's going to cause a recession when we do that. Even more so than we're in now. So Carter, and they said, we can wait till after the election if you want. And Carter's response was, will that make it worse? And they said, yes, it would. He goes, well, I can't do that to the American people. So he essentially put Volcker in knowing that there was going to be somewhat of a recession his last year that essentially he was going to cause. I don't think anybody since then would ever have done that. That he's like, no, I can't make the recession worse just so I get my ass back in office, basically is what he told these people. And he agreed to it. I can't imagine anybody since then making that call, can you?
Well, I can't either, Tom.
I mean, and Volcker came in, and actually the last 16 months of Carter's term, growth in M2 slowed 8% annually, which is pretty quick to slow it like that. But I mean, this Iran hostage rescue attempt—what a bleep show that was, huh? They used my guys at Pullman told me they used. First of all, people say, well, "How could you screw something like that up?" Well, there was no SEAL Team 6 or anything. Didn't they use was it the Army, the Delta Force, or something? Didn't they use? And everybody had a part of it. Go ahead, John.
There's suspicions that that was a setup too. That was, you know. The last thing the Republicans wanted in that campaign year was for campaign season was for Carter to pull off a successful rescue attempt. So it wasn't, you know, strategically badly planned, yes, but also perhaps, you know, sabotage too. If you believe the October surprise theories, it's pretty easy to believe that extended to the attempted rescue, the failed, you know, attempted rescue too. So,
but they never actually got into Iran.
Right.
No. There was I'll give a real brief, and you probably know better, John, but they started out with 8 helicopters, and the idea was they're going to do mid-air refueling, right? And they found a spot somewhere in the desert they were going to use a staging area. And there were 8 helicopters, and the deal was that if 4 of them or 5 of them, I think if 4 of them were still okay, they were going to go forward. Well, they get there, and 3 of them, it had gone down because of sandstorms or something. The refueling thing screwed up. The whole thing was a mess. And when they only were down to 5 helicopters, I think Carter made the call to not go forward because it had all the visions of just a botched attempt. And they had, but they used Sikorsky helicopters, which my guys at Pullman at the time were one of the guys was a helicopter engineer, and he worked for Bell or Huey or Huey was made by Bell. Was that Bell helicopter made the Hueys, John, or something like that, or Kevin?
Yeah.
But anyway, the Sikorsky was evidently notorious for not being able to do anything in the sand. Matter of fact, I think he had to change the rotor or something like every 3,000 hours to the tune of like $1 million or some number. So it was absolutely the wrong thing to use. It's you know what its original purpose was, Sikorsky? For like minesweeping and laying mines in the ocean. It wasn't designed to go over a desert. Anyway, so they had 5 serviceable helicopters, and I think Carter said, this thing looks like it's in bad shape and we're calling it off. So they didn't go forward. They never actually made it into Iran. And then, of course, one of them's taken off, bangs into one of the planes that's supposed to be refueling, and there was a big crash, right? Big explosion?
Yep.
That the world was laughing at, basically. But there was no, and then after that, it was how many years before they decided, hey, we need a force that does just this kind of stuff. And you end up with SEAL Team 6 and those kinds of people. Before then, everything was combined, right, with different people in charge and all kinds of stuff. It was all screwed up.
Yeah. Well, the Canadians were in on it too, right?
They might have been, but somehow or another, they were going to be refueled from sea, weren't they, Jen and Kevin?
Yeah, it was such a disaster. And, of course, you know, the country had descended into a real malaise over that. I mean, but I look back on it, the disillusionment with government during Watergate and the intensity with which people watched the collapse of the Nixon administration after the landslide re-election in 72 when McGovern carried one state, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
You think it would be flying high? In 2 years, the country had just sunk into total distrust of everything surrounding Nixon, and you know, Nixon unfortunately played into a lot of people's worst suspicions, and he had some horrible people around him that he kind of lost control of. And I can think of parallels now between that era and the Biden presidency that's wrapping up now, as far as a country that had become exhausted by things that they couldn't quite comprehend on how bad everything had gotten in government, and Carter came as some kind of a solution to that. And had it not been Carter, it would have been perhaps some other Democrat, but it had to be somebody completely detached from to Ford.
Well, John, you mentioned something that I had forgotten about. Kevin, do you remember how bad the cities were? I mean, New York was a bleep hole. I mean, Times Square was nothing but a bunch of porn shops.
It was horrible.
Downtown Chicago was a...
Chicago was a mess, too.
Well, they'd all these... you know, this is a... Talk about urban planning, and you know, I'd love you. We got to go to break here in a minute, but you guys comment on this. Somebody decided, I don't know about every city, but all the cities we were involved in, every city, the downtown area was somehow a bad idea. State Street, the buses and the cars and the congestion. Same thing happened in South Bend, of all places. That the downtown street should be no cars. You make it this pedestrian mall, and a car should essentially go around the downtown. Well, at South Bend, you can't go around in Chicago. So State Street was a pedestrian mall. It was a disaster. The whole idea, you had buses, but the whole idea of the, I mean, people liked the crowds and the chaos. South Bend.
Yeah. So what we did was we knocked everybody out of business right. Downtown.
Yes.
Which sort of left it to the thieves.
Well, yeah. But during the construction, everybody left, right? Everybody went to the suburbs.
And that was the goal too, Tom. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, and it's kind of a precursor of the whole green revolt that we've seen and the hostility towards fossil fuels and gas powered automobiles. That was the first foot in the door. That the reason the cities were failing was because of cars, and we needed people to get back on their feet and bicycles and push all this stuff. That we got bike lanes galore now in Chicago, and you can't move in a gas-powered automobile or an electric-powered vehicle because of the number of bike lanes that are taking up traffic space. We've sort of descended into the spiral, but that's the first instance I can remember where people started making really bad decisions in the name of very high-minded goals. And, we're still wrestling with how to do it better.
They have no idea how they're doing, John. I don't want to get into this because there's too much other stuff to talk about. We could identify a few streets here in the city where we put a regular old streetcar on it with a bike lane and pedestrians and no cars at all. We get a segregated couple of streets and solve all those problems.
Right.
If we wanted to. But we don't. We would mess up all the other streets.
I remember Carter, appeared on national television with his sweater, in effect telling everybody they have to dial down their thermostats.
Well, He took the oath of office. One of the first places in the country to have solar panels was the White House. I don't know if you remember that, but he took some leader gave some speech next to the solar panels. The first thing Reagan did was get him out of there, which I don't know was the right thing either, but he went the other way.
Right.
Well, we're going to go to a break. We come back. Let's talk about Greg Gumbel a bit. But we could talk about Carter forever because it was a whole time. And you know what? The older I get, I don't know if you guys feel the same way, this history just lingers. Even though guys like Greg here are kind of probably interested in what we're talking about, it never really goes away. It just kind of repeats itself and does other... I mean, it seems like it's yesterday, doesn't it? With the same issues as today.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes, it does.
S&P futures down 34, NASDAQ futures down 141. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. a longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR. Innovation in Human Resources. Licensed in Illinois.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. Normally on the show, we talk a lot about stocks and investing, and most retail investors stick to securities products. Stocks, bonds, indices, sector indices, and options on all of the above. Recently, however, the politics and economics of our time have caused a lot of the trading and possibly investing opportunities to occur in products that are considered commodity products rather than securities products. These products, such as agricultural commodities like corn and wheat, metals like gold and silver, or even oil and natural gas, trade under a different regulatory system, have quite a different set of trading rules, require a separate set of account agreements. We at PTI have been servicing commodities clients for over 20 years, and are an introducing broker to RJ O'Brien, one of the oldest privately owned independent futures firms here in Chicago. PTI brokers bring the same expertise to bear in the futures area. Every broker you're used to working with is commodity futures registered. So if you're looking to learn about trading commodities or are a seasoned trader, you may find it worthwhile to look at the people you already know at PTI Securities and Futures. If your next opportunity strikes the futures area, why not be ready to take advantage of it? Check us out at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com. Futures trading involves risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pappas in the studio. We've got Kevin O'Neill and John Flanagan on the phones. And we've got Matt Byrne on the board, keeping us all together. S&P futures down on 42. We're leaking a little bit. NASDAQ futures down 176. Dow futures down 110. Tesla's down $8. Meta's down 492. Big guys are all down. Microsoft down 3. Apple down 2. Amazon down 174. We're in Europe. We have the DAX down 21. Call that flat. FTSE down 6, call that flat. CAC around up 12.1%. I guess they're pretty much, I'd say that those things are pretty much flat. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei down 386, but still very close to 40,000. 39,894. Hang Seng down 49, 20,041, over 20,000. Shanghai up 7, up 0.2%. So those guys have still been hot over there as they continue to try and pump money into the system. Again, on Friday, Dow was down 333, S&P down 66, NASDAQ down 298. And it came back just about as much as we're down now. So I'd say Greg, are we pretty close to our lows on Friday? I think we got to be pretty close to there. Foreign exchange, dollar's still under 105. I mean, the euro's still down under 105, 104.46. British pound, 125.88. So the dollar still remains strong. Japan, 157.53. Oil, up 32 cents, 70.92. Brent up 23 cents, 74.40. Natural gas, wow, up 43 cents, 12%. 382. We must be getting a cold stretch here or something. That be colder in the last few days, that's for sure. RBOB unchanged, 196. We've got gold down $1, 26.30. Silver up 5 cents, 30.02. Not much going on there. And we have Bitcoin up 259, 93,709. Still high, but a long way from the 103 it was. Pretty quick 10,000 to the downside. What do you got for us, quick traffic, weather, sports?
Yeah, good morning. It's currently 6:44 a.m. on December 30th, 2024. Traffic right now, inbound on the Kennedy from O'Hare to Jane Byrne is at 18 minutes with the outbound at 15. Weather in Chicago, 35 at Midway and 33 at O'Hare, high of 41 today with some patchy fog. Tonight, chance of rain with continued fog. Tomorrow, slight chance of snow for your New Year's Eve. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, 36 degrees this morning, sunny skies and high clouds, high of 58 degrees for Phoenix. In the NFL yesterday, Vikings beat Packers 27-25. This marks the Vikings' 14th win this season and continuing their first placement in the NFC North. Tonight, Lions play 49ers in California. Game starts at 7:15 p.m. on ESPN and ABC. Lions placed second in the NFC North with Packers in third, and the Bears in last with 4 total wins.
The Bears.
Yep, not that good. As far as hockey, Blackhawks yesterday lost against Dallas Stars 5-1. So I got Chief, over to you.
Well, guys, yesterday the football on TV, none of those games were any good. Where did Kevin? They weren't involved. Most of them hit the teams that are already clinched. There's only like one or two spots left open, right?
Yeah. Well, there were games that mattered yesterday. There were several that mattered. Hey, I want to dispute the Phoenix weather forecast though. We're looking at 73 today and sunny.
So what is Matt have you doing? He's in the wrong town, or where is he?
Let me check.
73 and sunny sounds good, Kevin.
I enjoyed watching the Packers play the Vikings. That was a good game.
You know, this is according to the National Weather Service. They say they're giving me 36 degrees in Phoenix.
In Phoenix?
Is that right?
Maybe
it doesn't sound right to me.
No, it's 44 right now. It gets cool at night. I'm in Phoenix. That's why I'm disputing
them. Well, thanks for
But yeah, yesterday was beautiful. Today's supposed to be beautiful. A little cloudy tomorrow, but I'm going to the football game tomorrow evening anyway, so it doesn't, cooking chili tomorrow and then going to the football game.
Well, are you going to be when the Irish are not until kickoff's what, 7:45 in Central Time? Ew.
Be on earlier than that here.
Yeah.
New Year's night, yeah.
And then if they win, they get 2 more.
Yep.
Let's talk a little about Greg Gumbel, then we'll talk about some of these games. Because Kevin won't be on Wednesday. We're off for New Year's Eve. Greg Gumbel, Chicago guy, right? Went to deal with Sal. I'd like to see that. I mean, anybody ever said a bad word about this guy, ever? That I can remember? He was
not that I'm aware of, no.
Everybody from players to coaches to studio, his Bradshaw in the studio, they all loved him.
Yeah, and really good at his job. You know, that was the big thing. Now, you know, there's probably a lot of young listeners, and this could include you, Greg, that don't remember him doing the, I think it was NBC, that Channel 5 News sports, 10 o'clock news.
Yeah, he was good there.
He was their sports guy for, that's
CBS really lost the rights to the NFL, I think, in 90, and he moved to NBC.
But this is long before that. This is when he was doing.
Yeah, this is like his beginning job. His roots were as the Chicago, the sports guy on the evening news.
You know, he got how he got the job. Have you read this?
His younger brother tipped him off.
His brother was Bryant Gumbel was working for
television.
Yeah, he was fortunate as a TV sportscaster in Los Angeles. Informed him that the NBC affiliate in Chicago was looking for somebody. So he auditioned and got the job, and the guy who, before I talk about making a right impression, the guy who got the job, he was here 7 years. The sportscaster he replaced, a guy named Dennis Swanson. I don't remember him. Do you, Kevin or John?
I don't remember him as a broadcaster, but I know of him as an executive.
He went on to become the president of ABC Sports. So the guy you replaced ended up being pretty good. I mean, then he went to
a pretty good ally to have.
But he bounced around only because for a while CBS or NBC, he went to CBS and CBS lost football. They were outbid for a while by NBC. Then they got it back, right? It was Fox and NBC for a while, and then it went back to Fox and CBS. And now NBC only has his.
And now it's everybody.
Well, they got the Sunday night game. They got the, and they've got a couple of playoff games. Greg maybe could check. I think that NBC pays almost as much for Sunday and for a couple of the playoffs and like the first game of the year on Thursday as the other two play for all the games on Sunday. That's such a hot spot, that Sunday night. I think
I'll have to believe you, but I could see it.
But he did the Winter Olympics. He also was a backup to Marv Albert, of all people, a New York Knicks broadcast. I mean, you can do all those different things. You got to prepare for all that. I mean, it's not easy to do, is it, Kevin? I mean, to go from basketball.
It absolutely isn't, and you can tell the difference when the good people, especially even whether you're calling play by play or whether you're the sidekick, it doesn't really matter. You can tell the people who do their homework and the people who don't. What's his name? Gumbel was one of those guys who would do his homework. He would be very informed about the teams he was covering, about the people he was covering, if you want to know somebody who adds to a broadcast, that's how you do it, is by being prepared and being able to speak, you know, directly to the specific circumstances. And how many times, you know, will you watch, you know, a Chicago team on a national broadcast, and you hear someone, you know, just dropping some little plum out there, and you go, well, that's not true,
right?
Because, you know, we've seen the coverage all week, all season, you know, all time. You go, that's not true. This guy's just, you know, kind of making it up as he goes. And then, you know, my next question then is, boy, I'll bet you he says that kind of crap about every team that he covers.
Well, you know,
you've got others who are just very informed and very knowledgeable about what they're doing.
Well, you know, he had the when you got the, you know, the attractive persona, the nice smile and everything else. You assume the guy got it because of that and didn't know anything, and he almost disarmed you because he actually did know all this stuff. You know, his great great grandfather was a German Jewish immigrant. So that he was what? Where does that put him? 1/16th white or something?
Well, it makes a mixed race.
Yeah. Well, what? How far down you got to go before you're not great great grandfather? That's a long way. What's that? Is that 1/16th or 1/32nd? My math is a little.
Yeah, don't know, don't care.
Yeah.
For me, I don't care.
But he ended up, I mean, De La Salle, and they're still open. I don't know how well they're doing, but.
Yeah, De La Salle, you know, they used to, we used to have to prepare specially just for De La Salle when I was in high school. Because they had a habit of trying to nail you in a strategically delicate spot with the helmet, you know, when they were blocking. And literally, we were taught, you know, we practiced that week just pushing, you know, if a guy wanted to go that low, pushing him down and stepping on him.
God. John, do you have any, I'm asking you because I don't know, one of my best friends is, he's the chairman of the board of Mount Carmel, which is a near South Side high school, call it sort of a bad neighborhood high school, Catholic. The other two are De La Salle and Hales, and they're both still open. John, you have any idea how well they're doing? They can't be doing too well. John, are you there?
I think John is currently muted.
And John, I'm going
to... Sorry about that.
Unmute thyself.
I'm unmuted, I hope.
Yes.
Hales Franciscan closed several years ago.
Oh, they did? Well, that answers one question.
Yeah. They tried to, you know, keep it afloat, and they were struggling to keep enrollment up, and it was a real shame. It was a real loss to the neighborhood, and to the South Side, we folded. So there's De La Salle and Mount Carmel, and the others, well, Brother Rice, Marist, your alma mater, Tom, and St. Lawrence. St. Lawrence has gone co-ed, as
has St. Rita.
St. Rita,
which is struggling, struggling, and I don't know how. Who's the guy who was the?
Mendel closed, you know, the
a long time ago.
School. Yeah,
the Mendel had probably the most beautiful campus you ever seen in high school.
The Pullman Technical School.
Yeah, yeah. But then I don't know what. They're I should know the name before I bring up the subject. One of the guys who just died, who was one of the, wasn't he one of the partners on the Bears or something? He had like a bunch of kids. Maybe nobody really liked the guy, but allegedly. Wasn't he like the patron saint of St. Leo? I don't know how Leo's going to stay alive without him. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Leo was, you know, Christian Brothers School, too, like De La Salle. And their enrollment has really dropped. They're still going.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, like a 200 students or something. I'm very pleased that they've kept going. But it's got to be a real struggle. So
you know who's still going? It's got to be an amazing struggle. Is Visitation? They're still open.
Oh God.
Yeah. All right, Kevin, Ricky Henderson. While we have you,
Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Two things about Ricky Henderson. is he holds the career stolen base record and the season stolen base record. Nobody's surpassed that, have they?
No. Oh, God, no.
No, 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 no way. And he also holds the record for most leadoff home runs.
I saw him in a casino in Las Vegas. Even if you didn't know the guy was a baseball player, you just kind of recognized him. He was walking by. He had to be, I'm going to guess, 6'6", just one long, thin muscle. You look at the guy and you go, I don't know what sport he plays, but he's played something. Kevin, you're going in and out. Your connection's no good. From the desert. You gave the wrong weather forecast, and they cut you off. Just saying. Kevin, you have to call back in, bud. Or do something. So, yeah, Jan, he was...
All right, I'm back.
He's got the walks record, too,
he's
right?
He's got the walks record. But, you know, as I sent you guys an email last night, you know, he's another guy that played for Oakland all those years. Ichiro, Mike Trout, him. Those are guys I never get to see. But, I mean, he was unbelievable.
Yeah, he did get a lot of years playing for other teams, though. So yeah. you had some opportunities.
But just the minute you saw the guy, first question in your mind is, this guy a basketball player? Is he a defensive back in football, or is he a baseball player? I mean, you just looked at him. You know, wait a minute, this guy, he looks different than most other people. I mean, I don't know who else. Maybe like an Ernie Banks, some, you know, people that have that long, thin, where they can do whatever they want type of thing. But, yeah. You know, he was one.
And the conditioning and everything, he played 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, the conditioning that it takes to be able to perform at any kind of decent level. Now, his last few years, he wasn't very good with the Mets, with Seattle, the Padres. You know, he was kind of bouncing around. But even 20 years in, you know, he was still posting, 300 batting averages and so on. Just an incredible athlete, very driven man, very, you know, you don't accomplish at that level unless you really have a lot of admirable traits. And it just... pretty awesome baseball player.
So we're gonna test Kevin's sports knowledge, which I usually screw up when I do that. What was amazingly unique about him, despite all the records?
Despite all the records,
it had nothing to do with the records.
Yeah,
but
he didn't hit a lot of triples, and for that matter, a lot of doubles either.
Dan, he's missing this. It's rare to stump to Kevin. Well,
I'm right about that, though.
He threw left-handed and batted right-handed, which almost nobody does.
Wow. Oh, that's true. Yeah, I get that.
In all of baseball, other than pitchers, how many, I don't know if it was starters or how many ball players have done that in all of baseball? I was stunned when I saw that.
I don't know. What's the number? That'd be an inch.
It's like 57. I was stunned when I saw that.
Wow.
I mean, nobody does that. Because obviously you'd like to bat lefty if you could, because there's more right-handed pitchers. And most people throw right-handed, so if you could figure out a way to bat lefty or switch hit, you usually got a leg up. But I mean, almost nobody wants to go the other way. Because there's only like
And throwing left-handed is not an advantage.
There's only, what, there's...
You're limited in the positions you can play.
Really, there's only three. Well, that you're ideal for, right?
Yeah, first base and the outfield.
But even which one of the left field you don't even want to be... You don't even want to be a left-handed in left field because you got to make the step.
Yeah, it's doable, though. It's doable. It's doable.
But right field, center field, and first base and pitcher are about the only spot that you really designed for, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But he said when he was younger, he saw everybody batting right-handed and thought that was what you're supposed to do, so he batted right-handed.
Also could have played football.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I bet he could have. I
mean, his mom was the one who said, no, you got to play baseball because they play longer.
But he also is one of these guys that talk about, you know, the demise of the family. I mean, the dude's 65. He was born in Chicago. His dad, of course, takes off to Oakland. And he was raised by his grandmother for a while until finally they matriculated out to Oakland where the dad was. So he croaks.
And that's...
And then the mother married the new guy, and the new guy gave him the name of Henderson. His name wasn't Henderson to start out with. Everybody has a history.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, Kevin, what do you make of the sports new year? We've been going back and forth on the internets and stuff, and our guys are a gas now that everybody's going to play 6 years with that court decision. Why is everybody resisting where this is going? It's just going, isn't it?
Well, as any Borg drone can tell you, resistance is futile.
Yeah. The Borg.
Is that a Star Trek reference?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Well, resistance is futile, right?
Yeah.
And
well, we got those AI chips and Neuralink stuff coming, so pretty soon.
Yeah, pretty soon. But I don't. Where does everybody think this is going to? I'm convinced, Kevin, that there's going to be people that go to Notre Dame, Michigan, you name it. They're going to go to school. They're going to go to business school. They're going to go to law school, and they're going to play the entire time they're there, because they're in college, and they're going to go on to their other career after playing 6-7 years of football or basketball, making a lot of dough, and say it's time to go do something else, and they're never going to see the NFL.
Well, maybe. I think beyond football. Think of basketball.
That's what you're saying. Basketball too.
Because there are tons of guys who are really, really nice college players in basketball who are never, they're never going to play in the NBA. Because the NBA is kind of a freak show. You have to be so off the charts talented just to get into that league. And so a lot of these guys will go play, you know, in a Euro league, European league, or Australia or someplace like that. And the pay is good, but it's not great. And now with what you can earn in college as an athlete, maybe it makes the economic sense as well. So, I could see that really being more of a thing for college basketball players wanting to play that 6 years while they get advanced degrees.
Well, if you're making money, what's the difference? I mean, this kid from Vanderbilt sure looks like he wants to play 6 years of football, doesn't he?
Yeah, perhaps. But again, you know, I think that there's probably, if you're a genuine NFL prospect, just like if you're a genuine NBA prospect, there's more money to be made going that route. Financially, it makes sense to play in the NBA, because not only do you get the same kinds of endorsement opportunities that are the reason people are in college, you also get the benefit of the higher salary that the league pays. In basketball, however, if you're going to go play in a Euro league, you can do just as well financially staying in college. Stay, get an advanced degree while you're at it, and set yourself up for the rest of your life.
I tell you what, I think, John, I'd love to have you opine on this. At some level, I would, if it was me. Kevin, you played football. I did. I played in all the different touch and those kind of leagues. But I'm going to say, well, we were 3 years in grammar school, then you'd be 4 years in high school. If you go another 6 in college, and by the last 3 years, you're making, let's just say, 6 figures, you're getting a Michigan law degree or MBA, and then you're going to have a name for yourself, and you're probably going to get immediately hired by somebody good because they know your name, and by the way, you got your MBA or your law school, you're going to go to a good law firm. That just might be enough for me. I mean, what do you think, Jen?
Well, I'm more concerned with what it does to the profile of the typical college player when you have a wider age span of people competing with each other. What does that do to the injuries? What does it do to the, you know, success, you know, rate? Would you have to hang around for 8 years to really prove your mettle? So you got people who are 30 coming back to college, or I don't know what it does to the sport as, you know, a spectator sport, let alone as, you know, the dangers or the, you know, the risks associated with it when you've got people who were overmatched by people who were bigger, bulkier, stronger than the younger ones.
Well, you're the oldest one here. What did they do like in George Gipp's time when he was 24, 25, wasn't he, Kevin?
Yeah, he was older. A lot of guys were older. Yeah, that was odd.
Yeah.
But yes, when you're talking, what John's talking about is when you get people 24, 25 years old playing against 18 and 19 years old, the physical maturity is a big difference. it's a big difference in any sport, probably bigger in football than any other.
Yeah.
Well, but Jans are...
And back in the GIP days, the sport was very different. I mean, you can see it in newsreel footage and the amount of protection. I mean, they had less protection than they do now, but they don't have enough protection now, it seems, for the kind of injuries you can get. So I wonder what it does to the whole, the recruiting part of it. What kind of a team do you have to kind of put together in order to compete? What's the kind of, profile you're looking for, and who are this going to be the successful team? So I just that's a whole different issue, and that's looking at it from a purely personal or health issue.
But Jan, don't forget who you are on the show. You are a lawyer.
Yeah. Right?
So if you're a judge, and somebody says,
I'm
"Hey, I'm
here," risk assessment,
But if you're a judge and somebody says, "Hey, I'm here," just like the kid last week or 1 or 2 weeks ago. If I'm a judge, I'm in school. I'm here for 5 years, and I got a 5-year major. Why the hell can't I play? Is it your job to say, "Gee, you're playing with an 18-year-old. You'll be too tough for him. I can't let you play."
Well, it'd be interesting to see how far you can get with that these days. I don't know.
Well, I mean,
are we looking?
Go ahead. Well, the question is, can you make it an age group, a specific age group? Now there's precedent for that, but it's all part of collective bargaining. So it's once you bargain for this stuff, you can do it. But there's no there's no group for bargaining right now in college among college athletes. So there is no organization. Plus, I don't know who. I guess the NCAA would be the bargaining side, the management side of it. But when I say there's precedent on the NBA side when they've set the lower level or the minimum age limit of 19, because they got tired of drafting guys out of high school who didn't pan out.
Would it be like having gradations and weight and size like you would in boxing? I mean, do you have
lights and the heavies like in high school?
Lights and the heavies, stripers in grade school. If you weighed too much, they put a stripe on your helmet and you couldn't carry the ball.
I believe that was 140 pounds, wasn't it, Kevin?
I don't know. Whatever it was, I never quite made it to striper when I was that age. But
to be 140
there now.
Well, this is the part that it was we see our threads with all our guys go back and forth, and the guys we graduate with they're all smart guys, but I'll tell you, in my opinion, I'm not telling anybody in my opinion, but I think I got a winner here, guys. You see. I mean, if Lou was here, he'd be arguing with me big time. You see, Major League Baseball never should have been, never should be, a monopoly. Same thing with football. They piled in there. Even though they don't have one, they act like they do, and they sure get away with it. Now, for the people to have to negotiate with them, okay, they formed a union, and they had to negotiate with a body, right? Well, you're never going to get a body like that again. So there's never going to be anybody to negotiate with. It's just going to happen. Anybody who tries to form an NFL slash
association,
an association right now is going to be shot down, just like the other one should be broken up, in my opinion. And Major League Baseball shouldn't be a monopoly. They shouldn't be able to tell you and me if you can't have a team within 70 miles of somebody else or wherever the hell it is and be affiliated. Well, where do they get to do that? But that's not going to happen in college, I don't think. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see that happening. I mean, they've lost every single case, haven't they, Kevin?
Well, yeah. I mean, that latter example you used about distance, that would sort of screw up Duke, North Carolina, and North Carolina State, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what Jan just mentioned, now, economically, Jan, what would happen if you were a parent now? There's going to be some schools... If we think that you're going to have, what's the number you think, Kevin? 50? They're going to be in this new dynamic. You're paying everybody and doing all this stuff. Pick a number. Say it's 50. Maybe if your son is a freshman, he goes to Miami, Ohio, and plays there for a couple of years. And then all of a sudden, if he gets good, bingo. He's a Ohio State or Michigan or Alabama or some damn place. I mean, you'll find a way around it if you don't want to be playing. Go ahead.
I could see that. You know, the way the conferences are reshaped, and you know who's playing whom, and that. I mean, but that's all starting from square zero right now. We don't have any kind of way of configuring this ahead of time. It's going to have to be done after seeing what are the problems associated with it, and where all the risk factors are accentuated, and do you really want to affect the risk factors, or do you just want to throw everybody in the same pot and see what happens? I could see it going that way too, as far as increasing the viewers, making it more of a rollerball kind of engagement. So,
well, I had lunch last week or 2 weeks ago with a client, and hopefully, guy becomes a friend and comes on the show. Really enjoyed a former quarterback at Notre Dame who's now an attorney. And the gentleman is my client, real good guy. Somebody has to make some rules. And we kept saying, who's the somebody? Anybody who raises their head and said, I'm in charge here, I don't think, they get shot down tomorrow, John. What do you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's going to, it'll be, once it becomes a collective bargaining, problem or solution, however you want to look at it, you'll see things progress and change and be tested, and but in the going forward, I see it's going to be like the Wild West for a while. I just don't think that anybody's got the kind of persuasiveness to make rules ahead of time until people see what really we're up against.
Well, other than
I think
it's persuasiveness, but I also think it's the vision. I don't think anybody's ever articulated a vision of what it's supposed to look like.
You're right, absolutely. That's one of the biggest problems, and somebody's got to think a lot of this through. That I can't do it, but I can see that the risk associated with not thinking it through ahead of time. And I think that there's likely to be a kind of blowback if this is not done effectively or compassionately or whatever label you want to put on it, but we're kind of feeling our way, definitely.
Well, Jan, there's no rules for law firms. There's no what if 50 law firms decided to get together.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Well, I'm saying, what if 50 law firms decided to get there and say, wait, it's now our way or the highway, and we'll negotiate, but only with us? First question is going to be, who the hell are you? I think
right. And any of the professional organizations or bar associations are part of the problem, not the solution. They're enabling this to happen, really. So,
what makes you, when do you think, what's your over under? I'll direct this to Kevin first. Of the standard, it's my understanding that every kid, no matter what sport they're in right now, male, female, whatever it is, signs essentially the same NCAA letter of intent, correct?
Correct.
I'm going to say I give that a year before every school says, I don't care what they're signing there, it's what you're signing here. If I'm putting up this money for you, you owe me 2 years or you owe me something.
I think that'll happen within 3 to 4 years, I would say.
Yeah, I was gonna say
you
summer,
you will see it be less a letter of intent and more a contract.
Contract, yeah.
Now,
part of the problem that you will have in the recruiting process is that some of the prospects have to have their parents sign the letter of intent right now because they're 17. When you have to be the right age to execute a contract, which is generally 18. That's a small thing, but it's a thing that they'll have to address, because I don't think that that a parent gets to sign away a kid's employment rights for the next couple of years. But I do think you'll see some kind of term commitment that will be required. They'll probably, my guess is they'll probably aim at 3 and get 2. But it'll be something like that.
What do you think about? I had a couple questions for you guys. You know, all kinds of. That's the beauty of it. You guys give your answers, you immediately come up with other questions. One of my buddies, and you've met him, Kevin, I believe, and maybe John has too. You remember Kendall? He knows a guy. He's got a guy. Kid's some kind of spectacular athlete. I don't know what the hell. I don't know if it's football or basketball. Kid's got a contract in high school with a shoe company. Now, the old man had to sign that, right? Okay, so I can't believe the kid's 18 when he's in high school, but maybe he is. I'm saying he's not. So now, if it's with Nike or somebody, or if it's with, say it's with Under Armour. Under Armour has Notre Dame. Who else, Kevin? They must have a few other schools.
Oh, they got a lot, yeah.
And what, Northwestern's Adidas, I think, or something. Anyway, or what if they give the kid the $100,000? I think it was six figures, believe it or not. And they give the kid the $100,000, and you know, he spends it, or spends part of it, and all of a sudden, he gets a better offer from Oregon, Nike, and which is a Nike school, and off he goes. I mean, can
you're
the
already seeing a certain amount? You're already seeing that.
But can the old man essentially enjoin the kid? This is what you have to do. He's the one signing it, and but then all of a sudden, does Under Armour get to say, I want my $100,000 back. You didn't go to a. And what if he doesn't have it?
Well, that's a problem too. John can talk about that from the legal aspect, and Lou would be able to get into it as well. It seems about as enforceable as when we were young, the Columbia Record Club agreements.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the first part, if
John's laughing at those. For those not old enough to know,
yeah,
you used to be able to get for, like, you know, 1 cent or 10 cent or a buck or something, they'd send you like six record albums, but then you had a commitment to buy one every month. And of course, nobody would ever buy one every month, and they'd send you these collection bills, but they couldn't enforce it because we were children.
Right. Book of the month, all this, the same kind of stuff. You know, you get roped into these things and just keep sending them. You know, I'll keep them, but I'm not going to pay for them.
Well, I mean, plus if you get the, this is something you don't really hear from people. If somebody gives a kid 100 Jeezles, and it's in November, well, if the money's unencumbered, and it's just, if he actually got it, he's got to send a $30,000 check to the government at the end of the year, so he doesn't have the 100 to give back, even if he didn't spend a dime, right, John?
Yeah, it'll have to be some way where it comes lienable. You know, you've got a liquidated damages clause in the contract, if you'll walk out or take your business someplace else, and you're leaving somebody, you know, stuck, there's going to be a way of coming up with what that amount is, and that will follow you in the form of a confession judgment of some kind, or a restriction, you know, where they they're enabled to come after you, whether to enjoin you from doing this, like a non-competition clause. So I think it's, you know, again, this is, we just got the foot in the door here. Yeah. I'm kind of like amazed at where this could go.
I would love to be, talk about being a pain in the ass. I would love to be, I don't know, I don't want to be on the board of Notre Dame, but if the coach came in, much as I really like this guy, I'd have my list of 10 questions or 8 questions. I'd grill his ass. How much does it cost you to recruit somebody? Go give me a whole list of what is a normal recruitment goal like? How much does it cost? And by the way, when are they ready to play? I would love to do an analysis, Kevin, on just how much it costs. Now, if you recruit 10 people and you get 3, well, then you got to multiply the 3 by what? At least 3 and a third, to figure out your cost of recruiting every guy. And if it turns out it's, you know, $300,000 to recruit somebody, why do I want to recruit anybody ever when I can just get them through the portal?
I mean, you got to recruit them there too.
Well, somewhat.
It's the same process now.
Not really.
Yeah, it is. they do visits. It's just condensed, generally, but it's the same process.
But you know what I'm saying? I mean,
they spend a fair amount of money bringing people in for visits and all those kinds of things that they do.
Well, I heard of one of the schools, I won't say what it is, flew somebody's mother to the place on a private jet to show her around campus how nice the place, how to take care of her kid. Because the family had a lot of money, and they weren't being bought off by regular money. But, I mean, what do you think it costs to recruit somebody on average? 50?
Don't know. Have to put that together.
Because none of these coaches are flying on Southwest, are they? I doubt.
No,
I don't think so. Yeah, you see, Mark. I'm sure I'll see Marcus Freeman in this. What is it? What do they do on Southwest? A, B, and C? Or,
well, not anymore.
Like,
no, I guess you get the assigned seats. But
oh, okay.
But I mean, even the assistant coaches are going private jet, right?
Less so.
And they're bringing the kids up there. You're not gonna plunk your recruit on Southwest, are you, if he's a five-star?
Depends on whether it's an official visit or an unofficial visit.
I mean, I wonder
where's the coach in all of this too? I mean, you got a whole layer of recruiters, and the way representations could be misrepresented in conversations with a kid, you know, and they're going to look at, you know, what the bargaining strengths of either party is in any kind of a conflict. I just think that there's now such a layer of management that the coach is really, in some ways, I think, just completely shut out of. And it's the other exposure that a university has in the way they, you know, have made promises, representations in different conversations, or they may have a signed agreement of some kind, but God knows what's gone into that. There's a whole fleet of people doing this nonstop. So what it costs to recruit them, I guess, that's an important question.
Especially if the kid's 17 and he's raw, the first year or two of physical training, college, food, you name it, that's all part of it. Plus, if he's getting paid, you got to do that too, right? Kevin, in the midst of this whole mess, I mean, we kind of know how this used to go. I mean, you were recruited a few places, I never was, but people show up, it's the coach, talks to the high school coach, or if it's basketball, it could be the AAU guy and not really the high school coach. But somehow you get in this flow, and you walk into the house, and somebody there, be it the sassy older brother or sister, the old man's going to say, okay, where's the money? Where does that conversation, I don't think the assistant coach can start rattling off the deal, can he? Or do you have any idea how that's answered in somebody's living room? Just, you have a clue? I don't know how you do that.
I'm sure they put them in touch with somebody. So I can think of the old days when this was not above board, and you would have, I don't even know that the coach would necessarily put him in touch directly, but you would be contacted by a booster of some sort, an alumnus of some sort, and that person would make the offer, and it would, you know, it would not be removed from that. Now, I remember one guy that Notre Dame was recruiting, and I'm aware of, and I won't say the other school that got involved, but it was a Midwestern. It was a Big Ten school. I'll leave it at that. And he had the offer from the money, so he had made the commitment to the Big Ten school. And then he was wavering and decided he might want to go to Notre Dame instead, and was told, you don't want to mess with the people who you'd be double-crossing here.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, it could be kind of gangster here.
But I just wonder, I've always, I don't know why, but I have this thing about logistics. Maybe because I was a trader. Okay, how exactly do you make the trade? How exactly does it clear? I don't know, I've always been a phobic about that. So I walk in, and it's young Johnny Flanagan, and Johnny goes, okay, well, what's the deal? We know the deals are flying. Boy, I don't know anything about that. But you know what? I'm going to go outside, and I haven't done my walking today. I'm going to go walk 5 miles, and I come back. Maybe you'll get a phone call. Maybe you won't, and then we'll continue with our discussion. I mean, is it that brazen? I mean, I mean it's got to be very awkward, no matter how you do it.
Yeah, well, you solicit the bribery world is a little awkward, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, it's not really bribery now; it's legit, but I mean, lawful.
But it's the same taint as you have with, you know, with the way star faculty are recruited at universities, and the kind of unbelievable packages that are put together to lure somebody there for an endowed spot, you know, an endowed chair in some academic department, and this is so. Turn into a real scandal in some places. It's pretty much based on how little work you have to do in order to get your name associated with the institution, and they'll give you everything you want. They'll hire your spouse, they'll hire out people in your family, they'll look at your house, who knows, a car, whatever. And I think that's kind of corrupted the whole position of a university in the way it attracts people, whether it's to the faculty or to their sports teams. And I think, you know, you got a bad model that's already in place with faculty, and I think it's going to trickle down, if it hasn't already, into the way, you know, you've got compensation packages and negotiations going on for their athletes. So,
but any sort of connection between the assistant coach and who's ever coming up with the dough almost implies, I won't say implies a guarantee, but it, I just did, implies that if you're gonna, if you don't get your money like the guy from UNLV, you're gonna sue the coach and the school as well, saying you sent me to Greg Pappas, Greg promised me $100,000, Greg didn't pay. Why do I not name everybody?
Well, you always do that in lawsuits, Tom.
Legitimately,
throw it's out there, and you see who gets severed from the lawsuit.
I don't see how does the school get severed from that?
Because they say it's a third party. We have, at best, an arm's length relationship with them, but that's all changing anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Well, I don't know that it's going to do that. I don't think they still want to go to that workman's camp stuff.
They don't want to, but they're going to have to.
Right, what happens the first 15 years from now when the first seven people sue Michigan for the brain disease and each of them gets like $10 million apiece?
Wouldn't be surprised to see that suit already.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they just fold the program. I think that's the next step.
I mean, it happens to people. I mean, and I don't see how. Well, I'll call him an acquaintance, but it's kind of weird. I think he played for maybe Evergreen Park High School, and for Penn. And we're not talking about. Well, you play football, but
yeah, you bang your head,
And and he never was quite right, and at certainly a young age, not 25 or anything, blew himself away, and parents always thought he had some problems. Somebody sent his brain out to where, Boston or something. Sure enough, he was loaded up with the stuff.
And CTE, huh?
Yeah, and I don't know that they're instituting anything against those places. I don't know if anybody ever has. I mean, did Durson's family ever sue the Bears in Notre Dame? Everybody's going to say, well, it could have happened in high school. It could have happened in grammar school. You know, maybe the old man slapped him upside the head. I mean, it's got to be fairly easy to defend, right? Saying it came from somebody else.
Yeah, it wasn't me.
It wasn't me.
I envisioned John Belushi saying, "It wasn't my fault."
Oh God. All right. We got to talk a little bit about. We won't have you guys on until after the new year, since by the time we covered deaths and everything else. What do you make of this? We only got 3 minutes, so I'm not going to go over a little bit. All day yesterday, I was hearing on the radio. Somebody had hair up their behind yesterday morning as I was driving around about the deportation of everybody and the different messages people seem to think they have. And, there's some, like you, Kevin, that will say, we had Trump on a show where he talked about getting rid of criminals and these kinds of other people, and yet they're interviewing people that voted for him and saying, wait a minute. The man said on day one, they're showing up at people's houses and everybody's the hell out of here in flat cars.
He patently did not say that. So,
well, but
think that, but that's not he said. That's not what Holman has said.
Okay, what I'm saying is an incredible amount of people think that's what they heard. And I wonder the spread, I started out by saying a lot of people have heard stuff differently than people think they said. But it happens on our show, for God's sake. I mean, I could say something. I mean, people are, the chief says we're in for a crash. I never said that. What I said was P.E. ratios are on a historical high level. Doesn't mean we can either grow into it or there's going to be some other problem. It doesn't mean we're going to... I never told you to sell anything, but that's what you may have heard, right? For whatever reason. Maybe you were...
Damn, I got to cancel that sell order.
Yeah. You might have been chewing something too loudly and you didn't hear the whole conversation. But I'm saying, and I've had people have written into this Quora thing, and when you start looking, what did George Carlin say? I can't believe how dumb the average person is and half of them are dumber than that. There's people have written in saying, how long when Trump's in office are all the prices going to start going back down, like a month or 2 months? And I'm going,
They're going up.
They're going up. I mean, a lot of people are convinced that we just elected the savior, and I think he's going to do a hell of a lot better job than he did the first time. I don't care who you are. You could be Solomon. You're not going to solve all these problems in 2 months. I don't think. But if you could, that'd be great. But
no, I go back to what I said about optimism. To the extent that people are optimistic about the economy, there's some benefit to that. But yeah, we know what some of the internals are, and they're not good.
Well, I have the three of you guys of different ages and backgrounds. What is your read on the current economy when you can get all kinds of different? If you got money, the world is your oyster. If you don't, you're struggling. What do you make of the fact that the governmental tax receipts are lower than last year? And I think they weren't much higher last year than the year before. But what does that say? Unless all of a sudden people are finding a way to cheat. Well, I don't know how you can do that. I mean, a corporation maybe can, or somebody. But a regular person, it's pretty hard for you to cheat. What do you make of these receipts being down in the household survey and employment actually being down? As much as we downplay, maybe because of my negativism on some of the stuff on the show, these numbers are coming in worse than my worst estimate. I mean, there's something wrong with these numbers, or could I even be being too optimistic? Is that even possible?
Well, I think the demographics are working against those numbers, Tom. You can't really point to any positive news about life expectancy in this country, and you can't. Yeah, if you look close enough, you'll see some pretty disturbing statistics about people who are out of the workforce, either because they're dead or disabled. We don't have a good handle on that because our population numbers are skewed by immigration. It's kind of, you know, recklessly applied, where we got people coming and going, but we don't really know how many people are gone. And this is something I think, you know, nobody really cares to talk about because it's kind of frightening. But I think that would explain one reason why tax receipts are way down and why the job numbers are so completely ridiculous, is that people have died before their time. They're not producing. They don't figure in money velocity numbers or anything else. And they've been replaced by other people who have been brought in. And it blurs just what kind of population we're dealing with. I don't think we know at all what's going on. And it's too terrible to confront.
Well, I think the employment numbers are, I think, can be explained by an awful lot of people having 2 and 3 jobs. I mean, that's an explanation of why they don't match. But societally, what is that saying, John? I mean, or Kevin? There are people. I'll give a real quick story. There was a guy from at Pullman. They claim he was the best plant manager ever, and he was one of these balance kind of guys where, you know, you've got your home, you got your family, you got your work, and they all should be in some sort of balance, or else something suffers, and if something suffers, they all suffer, which was kind of his view of the world. And he only worked Saturdays if he absolutely had to. Otherwise, you worked your 40-hour week, that was it. You're supposed to go home, take care of your family, play golf, play softball, or you're supposed to do, and come back refreshed on a Monday morning, if you ever could come back refreshed from families. But and he would come in on a Saturday, and if John Flanagan was there, he'd walk in and he'd say, "Hey, John, good to see you. Love your ambition, but your only reason you're here is for two: A, you don't have enough help, or B, you don't know what you're doing. Which one is it?" And he actually felt that that's what, and this is before people spent all day doing emails and that kind of stuff. But now I don't know that it's healthy for people, for families, the parents, to have 2.5 jobs, or you know, because one's doing part-time and they're both working full. That's going to come out somewhere. Kids' education, kids' behavior, someplace. I mean, some families can pull it off, but it's a tough deal. What does it say about us if that's the truth, if all of a sudden everybody has to start working 60 hours a week instead of 40?
Oh, it says we're stressing out everything about society is what it says. It's exactly what you're describing. We're putting stress on family life. People don't have that work-life balance, so we're putting stress on individuals and individual workers. We're putting stress on the children were putting stress on their academic performance because they don't, you know, it's already a big problem when parents don't get involved, and it makes it really, really hard for parents to be involved, because if you go home from your second job, the last thing you feel like doing is sitting down with the kids and patiently going through their math. You know, yeah. There's a lot of implications to this. And, you know, again, if somebody could paint, you know, what 10 years down the road could we make this look like? You know, what could we do to make, you know, to make our society look different? I think that kind of descriptive is powerful, and it needs to come from people in leadership roles. And instead, we're, you know, we quibble over stupid stuff.
Well, you need some people with ideas, and even if they're simple stuff. I mean, I don't know if he'll pull it off, but if somehow, you know, Pritzker's people or something can regenerate that Southeast Side to any extent, I would love to see a total relook at the map here in terms of, you know, dedicated streetcars and so going some places. I'd like to see a manufacturer here that makes them in Chicago, that employs 300-400 people constantly, which means there'll have to be some breakfast place around there and stuff, and all the stuff that goes with it. I'd love to see some of that stuff happen. I don't see any of that kind of vision kind of anywhere. I mean, it all comes down to some, and I know, Kevin, I'm not abandoning the big sort of things, but one thing I want to talk about, you know, maybe Friday, why are people constantly having to look to governmental largesse, tax deductions or tax break? Why can't, if people have an idea, just sell the idea, go to the market, get the money, do it, make some dough, pay the people back, and have some profit? That's the American way. It doesn't seem like anybody wants to do that. You have your nose up the ass of government or some sort of even the defense industry. We've talked with Mike and Lou about how much more we need to do, and yet we look and see we've got 1/10 the amount of firms we used to have. It's something, we're just all screwed up here somehow. And I don't know where would you start to fix it? I don't even know where you'd start.
Well, that was the point behind enterprise zones, which is contrary to what you just said, because it is a government initiative. But the idea that you wanted to make it attractive for someone not just to start a business, but to start a business in an area that was underserved, or it has been underserved to date, and to be able to make it where people can walk to work or take a short bus ride to work, or you know, something like that, because you don't want people to have to buy a car, drive to the suburbs every day, pay tolls, all those kinds of things. You want to start businesses in the neighborhoods that need businesses for their revival, and you know, I think that's, you know, that's a good approach. It can be done as a temporary approach. You know, it will help you get started. Maybe you get a 5-year head start or something like that. I don't think it needs to be a permanent incentive, because once you get to be wildly profitable, you should be fine. But I think that's it. I do think community, you know, the community leaders, the community activists don't do a good job. Because one of the things that is definitely good for the success of of the decaying neighborhoods is to churn the spending back through that neighborhood, which again ties in with the enterprise zones having more businesses there. You know, you should be spending on, you know, on local businesses. That's the model that has been really successful as an example for different Asian groups, especially Vietnamese, who came, you know, in the aftermath of the Vietnamese War, the Vietnam War, and settled in the United States in certain areas and churned the money. And they are now at the third generation, and that's the generation that moves out, that is, you know, out in the suburbs and totally assimilated into the...
Kevin, we're gonna have to dash line here, because we got... You know what? That's an incredibly enterprising group, though, Vietnamese.
And you do have a lot of a real entrepreneurial tilt to that, and you do you have the same thing in many Hispanic groups. So,
you
can build on that. You can build on that, but it's all got to churn in the same group.
By the way, we're going to probably go right to that without a break, but, I used to try and be on this one, outbid this one station for a morning show, and they had a Vietnamese group that was on there for years. They never lost a dime, Kevin, unlike Stocks and Jocks. They used to fight for the Chevy dealership, because if you were the Chevy dealer and you were a listener, you wouldn't think of going to any other Chevy dealership or whatever it was, every other food store. If they sponsored the show that I listened to, I'm obligated to at least talk to that guy before I bought a Chevy. Can you know anybody we know that has that attitude?
No, we look out for ourselves first.
Exactly. I'll go online and buy my Chevy instead of whatever. Kind of crazy. Oh, guys, I'll talk to you, obviously, boatloads before, and I'll talk to you on New Year's Day, and I'm sure we'll be texting during the game.
And I'll say hi to Audrey before I drop off and tell all three of you and all of our listeners Happy New Year.
Why don't you bring Audrey right on?
You, Kevin, and your family, too.
John, you're going to hang around with Aud?
Yeah.
Aud, sure. You with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning, everybody.
How are you?
Morning, Aud.
I'm fine. Another cloudy, gray day here. Gee.
At least you're not shoveling
it. Looking for some sunshine to come through here.
You're not shoveling it.
Well, that's true.
Can you imagine what yesterday would have been if it was snow?
Well, I do like the snow, too, though.
Yeah, as long as I'm the guy shoveling it.
Oh, please. That's what I have a snowblower for.
That's true. So, Jan, what's going on in the real estate world? I mean, it seems like it's you've been, when you and Nance come in, there's a slight change. There's more stuff kind of available. A little different groups. I did mention last week when Nancy was in. Tell a quick story about the young couple who would love to get rid of their house and buy the one you have listed, but the difference in mortgage rates. That was interesting.
It's just in the last few weeks. Okay, we had a nice little blip downward in mortgage rates through November. And the mortgage rates really went down to 6.5, 6.75, and that was a nice little respite for everybody. But just in the the Fed, everybody assumed that the mortgage rates were going to follow, and they have not. They have also ticked up again, so we are back over 7 again. So that's really kind of tapped the brakes on things. You could just see it in the numbers that post every morning. So the last couple of weeks, the winter market could be a tough market. And right now, with the interest rates going up higher, the holidays, we've seen a slowdown in the last few weeks. But I've got some people that did buy a house and now we're selling theirs, and they actually got caught on that blip up in rates. So I'm hoping I think we're going to see a little pullback in them soon. I'm hoping for that. It's a difficult time right now. We're seeing a little more inventory come on the market, but what's sitting is the stuff that, as I've talked about all the time, that's not ready to go, that needs updating. It's sitting, and I'm seeing price markdowns on those things. So if it's not what the general public wants, which is move-in ready, it's sitting, and you're getting a price cut faster than I've seen.
But we're still at the spot where it absolutely has to be move-in ready, because nobody's got any money afterward to pay for anything, right?
Yeah, I think that's the same. And to the point with your conversation earlier, people just money is, even if unless you're one of the half of 1%ers, I'm thinking, you just still feel that. You're paying twice as much for everything, and you haven't gotten a raise, so you basically are making less money. So people are pulling back. They're making do. They're making do with what they get when they buy their house. They're buying a smaller house. So you're seeing that pullback all around. People just don't have the money, and young and old, you're stretching more to get what you want and get less of your money.
But you don't really, how much do you gain by just a little smaller house? Not that much, can you?
Well, if you're going to drop down $100,000, that's
That's a lot.
A difference. Yeah, that's a difference if at a 7% mortgage rate. So it is just, yeah, it's clogging up the lower end market, which starts clogging up the first time buyer market because you have more people competing for a cheaper home than you did 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So this if we get things back down in the sixes, it'll start moving again. It goes to the fives, and we'll have everybody will start moving around, and that inventory will really free up. But until something happens with that, and you know, historically homes are still up there. So between high prices, scarcity of desirable housing, and the interest rate, you know, it's a tough time right now.
Well, we talked a few weeks ago about the CNBC article by Jeff Cox. But one of the things Trump should do is he needs, you know, 50,000 homes, new homes that come on the market, so the prices will come down. And that's a, you know, somebody, I think he's pretty bright, but he needs to dig a little bit more into theory of price. I have the book I'll give him, Milton Friedman.
50,000, that's nothing.
Or 200, whatever it was, some huge number. And I don't see how, I mean, you and Nancy have talked, the cost of replacement of these homes, what you think is a, should be a, let's put it this way. I'm going to say, just out of the blue, nobody knows where you live or anything like that, your house is worth $500,000. Okay, so let's put that number out there. Say it's 4 or 6, it doesn't matter. I don't think you can build it for that today. So if you say, okay, we want to build a bunch of $250,000 houses, what the hell are they going to look like?
Well, that's very true. You know, and that also goes back to the labor market. And, you know, you need more carpenters, you need more electricians, the price of lumber, the price of drywall. I mean, all of those things are still so elevated. Well, you know, hopefully we get price of energy down. That's going to start trickling down some other things, and we can settle everything down a little bit. It's a very big problem. It's not just a one thing problem. Everything's going to have to work together to get it down. And I truly believe it's going to be a better time coming for all of us. But it's been the last 4 years to make a big mess out of what we have. So it's going to take a little while to unravel it. I think we will. And the thing is, people have to live somewhere. And there, even the dearth of rental housing, there's very little rental housing. I think what the government has, of course, royally screwed up, and the Chicago Housing Authority has royally screwed up, and the state is, you know, they have no lower income housing. They've destroyed so much, and they, you know, in all these areas where they, you know, the people have them, I don't know why they just don't go all through the areas on the south and southwest side, and where they propose that they're going to build these work zones. They don't start planning for townhomes, not necessarily building more Cabrini Greens. I don't think that's the answer, but you need like the planned unit development housing. I don't know what John thinks about something like that, but something where it is a contained cost, or get these southern suburbs like Chicago Heights and stuff, get those taxes down where the people who are buying a $50,000 house are not paying $6,000 or $7,000 taxes to keep it. So that's part of the problem, is the taxation on very low houses, a very low priced housing, is terrible for people.
Yeah, I don't know how you, there doesn't seem to be much leadership in that regard. John, what do you think? I mean, is there any kind of...
I think the best way that, you know, to reduce the tax burden would be if there was some kind of, a climate where businesses felt free to open or expand and to hire and to, you know, get tax revenue back to areas that used to enjoy it and thrived on it and haven't figured out how to replace the loss of it, which is what's happening in the south suburbs, where the cost of maintaining, you know, services to a place like Flossmoor or Homewood or whatever, as businesses have dried up, it's all falling back on the homeowners, and they're suffering because, you know, they've seen their job situation alter so that there aren't the jobs there used to be, and they're footing the tax bill for those failed businesses as well. And it's an impossible spiral. I mean, there's no way this can continue. Audrey, I'm wondering, are you seeing any evidence in your client base of deals that are unraveling at the last minute because of changed circumstances? Say a job has evaporated or dried up, and somebody no longer qualifies for their loan commitment, and they have to back out of the deal because they lost their financing. Is there any kind of blowback from what's happening in the job situation and what you see, where it's causing people to lose, you know, the chance to buy a house?
You know, I haven't in my, I haven't right now, I have not seen that happening to me. I did live through that in the last recession with people where they're all set and all of a sudden the week before closing, somebody loses their job and all bets are off and off, it's off the table. So I know that it's happening. It's not, you know, happened to me right now. Because I've got a different market. I've got a lot of people who are pretty solid, you know, either retired people, own businesses. It's for the first time buyers, not quite the same. I've got a mix of people, but I've not had that happen. I know people it's happening to. I see it happening. Simply to your point is a lot of the people who are losing their jobs are the people who never thought they would, like in IT and whatnot. That was supposed to be pretty bulletproof, like being in medical field or something, but it turned out not to be true. And a lot of these people, that's, I think, a big deal when you somebody's lost a six-figure job, and it's not like you could replace that no matter how many side jobs you work. That's a pretty tough one to do. So I think that is going to be a problem. And I don't know what you guys think of this, but I was listening to what you were talking about earlier, and I think the future problem with trying to revitalize neighborhoods with jobs and stuff is that I think so much is going to be automated, so much is going to be done by AI. You're going to need 50% less people on the planet eventually. That sounds terrible, but I think that you're just not going to need the average person to do the average job, because I think you're going to see less and less people required to do what we need to survive. I know that sounds kind of futuristic kind of thing, but AI is going to change the world again. And I don't think a lot of people are ready for that. Well, I don't know if we'll all live to see it, but you can see it coming, and it's definitely accelerating. You know, that Pandora box is open for better or worse. And we're just not going to need as many people to do the same things.
Well, we are in some areas, but you're not going to build a house using AI. You're not going to build a bridge using AI. I mean, those are the areas where there is.
No, but you're going to have things that are going to be like going to be scanned and generated. You're not going to need as many like calculations. That people are going to build houses differently. You're probably going to do a lot more of like structural prefab type of things or whatever. But you're not going to need as much. You're not going to need as much physical labor in the world.
Well, that's probably
you're
true.
You're going to get robots. I think it's going to be very, very, a very accelerated industry in the next 15 or 20 years. It'll be very interesting to watch.
I think it's probably true, but I think we have, maybe because of COVID, maybe because people don't have the money they used to have. When I say money, a lot of people, there's more wealth than there's ever been, but it's mostly in the stock market. But if you were to take, how many people, we talk to Dan Janitas every week, Jen, how many more people in Florida, engineers and tradesmen, do you need in Florida? 200,000? I mean, to get that place back together? I mean, you look at some of these cities, well, I haven't driven anywhere in a while, but I remember driving through Buffalo, and, you know, Buffalo's a real old city. I'm looking at these houses, every one of them is a frame. I'll bet I could put 30 grand of insulation, new windows, new anything in every one of those houses. And I'll bet, you know, we can save more power by fixing up people's homes than we ever can by taking them out of their cars and shoving them in electric cars. I mean, am I right, John? I mean, name me how many houses. Audrey lives in a nice area. How many houses on your block, Bud, need new windows, new something? I mean, if you had, they had the money, you could do something there tomorrow.
Well, that's true, but to your point, something like windows, which is now cost prohibitive for a lot. I mean,
well,
windows are crazy. Windows are up about 350% the last 5 or 6 years. If you've priced a window, you will just it'll blow your mind how much they are.
Well, yeah,
and it's probably for how I feel is windows are one of the least fun things to buy for your house. You have to have it. It's really no fun. It's a necessity. It's not like you're getting a new kitchen or something. And I would say that the average house, you could easily drop 50 to 60 on your average house for new windows without turning a hair.
And if the house is 25 years old, they all need them, right? Not all, but
probably. Some. Well, it depends. If you put cheap vinyl windows in, you probably do because they shrink and crack, and you end up having to replace them. Not like the old window, the wooden windows that you still see in some homes with the rope sashes. Wood is still the best insulator, I feel, but they're a lot of maintenance. And if you don't keep them up, you have a problem. But, oh, God, I mean, just, to refit windows in a house in a neighborhood that is struggling, I don't know how you could ever make that work right now.
Well, everybody knows this is going to, gets me a hair up my behind all the time when I look at these constant infrastructure projects where there's 100 people working when there should be 400. It's not like we don't have jobs for people if they want to do something and they have the education. I don't know what our new mechanism is, John. This thing with the Kennedy Expressway now, if our mayor or our governor, I'm somewhat of a fan of the governor, not any fan of the mayor.
You're the only one.
Well, after the fiasco of the last 2 years on this Kennedy, anybody who lets these people start next year's construction without a total rebid and a total come to Jesus meeting and saying, what's with you guys? You're 4 months late on this. The whole idea of doing something like this, other than a bridge falling down, is to save people time so they can do stuff. Am I right, John? I mean, the reason why speed limits are...
You're assuming this isn't built on graft and corruption to get the job.
But you live
in Chicago, you know better.
But it's not... That, I'm going to say, there's always been somewhat of that, but John, it's changed. It's the same people with no... I mean, the bridge out to you, the bridge to Audrey, the Audrey's Bridge. The bridge over to LaGrange Road was, 5 years? There were
it was ridiculous.
There's days I've gone by there, Jan. There are 5 people working on it. Until you can put a crew out here and act this off in a year, I don't want you to have the job. But yet, look around here everywhere. There's nobody working on anything except stuff's.
To get incentives. Like they used to build it into the project. Not claiming know a lot about it. That if. It was going to be due in June of 2025. If you finished 30 days, 60 days, 6 months earlier to the satisfaction, not a half-ass job, but a satisfactory job, then everybody got a bonus. The company got a bonus. They distributed it. So there was an incentive to work, an incentive to have. Used to see people working on the night shift with floodlights on the highways.
Yeah.
I don't know when I've ever seen that lately.
Was it because there's not enough people, there's so many jobs, they just start them and they get to them when they can get to them, or what? Something's weird.
There's no incentive to hurry. There's no incentive to be good right now. I would love to see the bid list and how that all these deals get awarded.
Well, this is, I'm not going to go too far with this because we only have a few minutes, but there is some sort of method to this madness, or there's supposed to be. If you look at the Jane Byrne Interchange, which it now is the way it was before, it ended up over time being somewhat of a bad design. Okay, but after the Ryan was put together in 1962, for God's sake, so we're talking about over a long period of time, could we have done it better? Well, duh, yeah. So you sit there and say, all right, if we do this, it's going to inconvenience people for how much? Now, you sit there and say, I guess we could go with Audrey's route and say AI, but the fact is you don't need AI. You sit there and say, all right, it takes everybody 35 minutes, 40 minutes on average to get through downtown. If we put this new one together, that's going to be 25 minutes or 15 minutes. So you're going to shave 15, 20 minutes off everybody's day. Now, in order to do that, you're going to have to make that an hour or more, right, John, for 2 years. Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll do that number. That means after the 2 years of construction and two and a half years or 3 years, we're going to get all that time back, plus we're going to have, for the future, we're going to have much more efficient people, more time to do other stuff, less gas used, you name it, all these benefits. Well, if your 3 years of the construction turns into 10, I don't know, should you ever have started the thing in the first place?
Well, it used to be that you could sell the time savings. You'll give people 15 minutes more leisure time where they don't have to be commuting or sitting on an expressway. Now nobody has any leisure time. They're putting that time into working another job. So, you know, there's no urgency to save people time because it's all, there isn't enough time in most people's lives as it is just to earn a living. And now that's why there's absolutely no cost control in any of these construction projects, because somebody is clearly seeing why are we bothering with this at all, and what's the point of speeding it up when it isn't going to save anybody any time in the long run.
Well, plus,
so let's just milk it for all it's worth, charge as much as we can, and hope it lasts another year.
Well, with the powers to be, because it doesn't seem like they know any of this stuff. I don't know why, or they should, or maybe it's the limousine. When you talk to somebody, say, "Man, I just got my toilet replaced in Lincoln Park, and I call this guy, and it cost me $300 to get the toilet replaced, and I bought the toilet." And you go, "Or $350." He said, "Man, that's like a hell of a lot of money. The guy was only here an hour. $300." Well, what you guys have just said, nobody's looking at that. If I live on 54th and Pulaski, and I drive to Lincoln Park and drive back, and I have to leave at 7:30 in the morning, I put this toilet in, and I don't get home till 1 o'clock. I don't care if it took me 60 minutes in your house. It's a half a day job because of the construction. Every person pays for that, right?
Oh yeah.
And then why don't these guys get it? Or maybe they don't pay for anything. I don't know. But I mean, one of the reasons why to have any kind of somebody helping you do anything in your house is the travel time, isn't it?
Oh well, yeah. You get very few places now that will consider the job going a big distance unless they bill you for the time and gas or whatever. So, yeah.
So Odd, what's your prediction for the year? You sort of gave it. Do you think next year's gonna be like this, or better or worse? What are you thinking?
I think it's gonna be a lot better year. I think springtime's right after the Super Bowl, because that is, as most of you know, the unofficial start of real estate season, when all you guys will get off the couch and out of the bar and stop watching games and go out looking at houses.
We're never getting out of the bar. I got news for you.
So I think it's gonna be a good year. I can't wait to get started.
Well, good. Good. You've had some good ones in a row. Most of your stuff, though. Although I will say this, Odd, you're not indicative of your business, because you have so many people that just want to use you.
I'm a lucky person. I have wonderful clients.
But I'm saying, what's it like? Are there new real estate people entering the business? Are people still leaving? What's the rest of the industry look like?
And it's like anything else. It ebbs and flows. People are retired. You leave the business, you come in. I think it's harder for young people now to get started in this environment. If they could get started in this environment, it's a difficult time to get established. And I tell any young person who asks me about it, this is like any other business model. It's 3 to 5 years to establish a new business, and you have to have the funds to hold on, because you are self-employed and there's not a thing that you don't pay for yourself. So you have to keep that in mind. You're self-employed, have enough funds to go into it, and give yourself 3 to 5 years to establish a base, and then go from there. But stick with it. It's a business I still love.
All right, you take care of yourself. And obviously,
Happy New Year, everybody.
And
Happy prosperous New Year to you, Audrey.
So, John, is there a chance I might see you for the game?
There is a time, actually, yeah.
I sure wish it was 3:30 and not 7:30, but...
Yeah, me too. Tell me.
We'll have to drink coffee instead of other stuff.
My God, you're showing your age.
Oh, God. SP Futures down 79. Ouch. NASDAQ Futures down 320. We're now lower than the low on Friday. I don't know if this is going to keep going. Right now, it doesn't look so good. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here, right now.
That's all, folks.
Inflation is our friend. For example, consider this. In the year 2000, if current trends continue, the average blue-collar annual wage in this country will be $568,000. Think what this inflated world of the future will mean. Most Americans will be millionaires. Everyone will feel like a big shot. Wouldn't you like to own a $4,000 suit and smoke a $75 cigar, drive a $600,000 car? I know I would. But what about people on fixed incomes? They have always been the true victims of inflation. That's why I will present to Congress the Inflation Maintenance Program, whereby the U.S. Treasury will make up any inflation-caused losses through direct tax rebates to the public in cash. Now, you may say, won't that cost a lot of money? Won't that increase the deficit? Sure it will. But so what? We'll just print more money. We have the papers, we have the mints. I can just call up the Bureau of Engraving and say, hi, this is Jimma. Roll off some of them 20s. Print up a couple of thousand sheets of those century notes. Sure, the glut of dollars will cause even more inflation, but who cares? Everybody will be a millionaire.